For me, the real difference maker is having a true teacher. The advantage is that, and this is really my opinion, I mean, I can't prove this, but it's not about any person. It is not about some great inflated personage at the top of everything. There is no such thing. It's sort of like getting a deer to eat out of your hand, where you only by being utterly still, and in a sense being no one and utterly nothing and still will the deer come and eat out of your hand. It's like that. It's like an opening that destroys error, it destroys falsehood, and you sit with it long enough and you may begin to notice, if you have a true teacher and you spend enough time with him or her, you may begin to notice what I'm calling consciousness. It's like a space through which freedom is accessed. Similar to an open door in a prison is nothing. An open door is open. There's nothing there. You enter it, pass through into another, I would say another world or another dimension, but you're going to make a concept out of that. And I would suggest you not do that, except to say, think about being in prison and what that's like, and then think about what freedom is like after having been in the prison. It's as if being a prisoner makes you think in terms of bars and even windows. You might think of windows as having bars in them and that you couldn't ever pass through. You couldn't ever be free because your world is defined by bars. Barriers. Walls. An open doorway is almost inconceivable. All you can really conceive of is the frame around the space. A frame is the door frame. The door is a barrier that has moved aside. And an opening is not anything. And yet it is something. So the mind tries to create something there, and it won't use it, because the way to use it is to just go forward. And there's no way to conceive of what freedom is, except to be free and do what free beings do, which is to exit prisons. A prison with an open door is not a prison anymore. As soon as you become aware that there's an open door and you could walk out, you're not in prison anymore, even if you're technically inside the building that we're calling a prison. It's an illusion to think that we're restricted in some way from being free. Truly, we can just walk out the door. It's just, we don't want to, because who would we be without our story? Who would we be without the bars and the suffering, basically, the restriction? If you want to be free, of course you're going to conceptualize what that is and desire it in a way that is a barrier. But if you work with a true teacher, he or she will be able to take that desire and destroy it. If you stay and commit profoundly to that work, whatever that is, it could be just sitting silently. That could be the work. It looks like nothing's happening, and yet a lot is happening under the surface of things. At some point, you start to become aware. And it's hard to explain because it's not a thought. It's like seeing the open door and it was there the whole time and you didn't realize it was open. Or you didn't even know what a door was. So it's always been there. What changed was a mental habit. Then there's a realization of something that's actually true, that is an access point to freedom. I'm saying, when you start to intuit that, that's real. The danger is in confusing your conceptualized version of freedom with the actual thing. A good teacher will help you. Now, could you do it by yourself? It's not likely. It's possible. I mean, Eckhart Tolle woke up, according to his description in The Power of Now, he was suicidally depressive. And he wanted to kill himself, and he couldn't bring himself to do it. And it was so intense that it provoked a confrontation that, for whatever reason, brought the awareness of what self was. The thought was, I can no longer live with myself. And it struck him as absurd, or it struck him as curious. That's awareness, that I can no longer live with myself is a certain thought. It comes up, wait a second. If there's the self and then the I that can't live with the self, are there two of me? And I wonder if one of them isn't real. And that's when he woke up, because he realized there's being and then there's the conceptualized self. And he realized in an instant, less than an instant, there's no time, just all that fakery went out the window, it was gone. And he described it as falling into a vortex. A voice said, resist nothing. And then that was it for him. He woke up the next morning and he could read about it. I just wouldn't wait on that to happen randomly. The question we started with was, why would anyone want to wake up? I've watched this show. They have these reality shows. There are three that come to mind. One's called Intervention. One is called Hoarders. And there's another one called My 600-Pound Life. We typically think of addiction as being to a substance. There are many types of addictions, but drugs, alcohol, that kind of thing. And then Hoarders, one could say, is an addiction either to storing things or to not getting rid of things. And they just pile up. And then My 600-Pound Life is, as far as I can tell, it's addiction to food. And in each of these cases, it's really unhealthy. But I was watching My 600-Pound Life the other day. I'm interested in that, what people go through. It's really a nightmare, weighing over 600 pounds. If you ever watch the show, it's typical for people to become bedridden at that point and just lose mobility, and death follows pretty predictably. It's horrible. But it's clear that from watching enough of these episodes that the one thing that these people live for is eating. Why do they live for that? Because when they're eating is the only time where they're happy. Getting up in the morning is extremely painful, difficult, and the only thing they can think about is their first meal that they're going to have, because that's the only time they feel happy. But the thing that's making them happy is the thing that's killing them and making them suffer. And it's really obvious. I mean, a drug addict can sort of fake being normal or healthy or whatever to a point. But if you weigh over 600 pounds, you cannot hide that. Unless you just never go out of the house, but you have to have someone to help you, probably, and at some point it comes out. Why would someone not want to wake up? Well, they would have to give up that thing that makes them happy. And it's basically a feeling of self that's superior and impregnable. And don't we all want to be captains of the universe, or chairman of the board, or humanitarian of the year? There's some kind of award. Actually, in addiction, the term is called reward. It's basically dopamine in the brain. And there's a sense of reward, and that's the thing that drives an addict, is pleasure. I wouldn't call it happiness, I'd call it pleasure. But basically, the way most of us would look at it, it would feel something like happiness. A really nice meal, or, you know, I enjoy having a glass of wine, and you know, there's a certain intoxicating effect, and it can feel good. It's like you have to let go of all of that and start over. You just cannot do what you've been doing. And if you look at these documentaries about addiction, it's just the last thing that an addict wants to get rid of. Like, I really, 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 really want to be free. I really, really, really want to be truly happy as long as I get to keep my drug or my food, whatever, or my house with all the crap in it, my old useless junk that I won't get rid of. We have to get rid of all of it. And at the heart of it is, when I say ego, it's an attachment to self. Who would I be without myself? It's a strange question. Eckhart Tolle's realization, I can no longer live with myself, or there are two of me, and is one of them perhaps not real? And then he wakes up. Because self is, it's like a craving after something that hurts us, but it's pleasurable until it's not, and then you want to get away. Suicide won't end it. Some people think that suicide ends suffering. It just doesn't make any sense. If suicide ended suffering, then we could just pass out guns to everyone and we'd all commit suicide and that would be the answer. It's not an answer. There's something more fundamental than that. As long as we're addicted to a sense of specialness, it's like a happiness that's based on being someone separate from and above mm-hmm. everyone else and everything else. You could be the most long-suffering, pathetic, small ego. That can be an addiction too. Because it's special. You're special in your suffering, or you're special in whatever. It's like we're all addicts and we're addicted to self, and awakening is transcending that. It just feels like, I'd say it feels like death, but it's more like surrender. The thing is, you have to maintain self in order to live. And in a process where you're trying to wake up, self is maintained, but it becomes like the frame around the doorway. So self is important for living, it's necessary, but it is nothing truly in itself. See, a doorway is nothing. Freedom is actually not anything, except it is something. It's just when we talk about it as human animals, we just conceptualize what we hear, and that tends to block it. But to think there's nothing is not exactly right, but it kind of is. Is a doorway nothing? Is space nothing? And we're getting into physics here. We have to maintain a sense of self. It's like structural integrity. It's similar to, I mentioned the show Hoarders. Well, a house that's packed full of junk is not a functioning household. It's just on the edge of death, really. I mean, if you live in a place like that, at some point you can't survive anymore. It's just really dysfunctional. And the same thing if you weigh 1,000 pounds or something, death is imminent. Or if you're a drug addict, that's a terminal situation as well. The typical human condition is one that's kind of like having a house that's full of stuff. And it's not as functional as a house that's less full of stuff. So it's kind of like we're full of shit. And through a valid teaching, we become less full of shit, more open. And there's less there. But think of a house that is packed to the gills with junk versus one that isn't. You could ask the question, when I get rid of all my junk, is it true that I have less? Well, you could say that you have more space. So it's kind of like that, where we're full of crap and then we do this work. And when I say full of crap, it's full of ideas that aren't true, full of lies, full of concepts. They're not useful. We clear those out and we become more functional. But the answer to being a hoarder is not just to torch the entire building, because then you would be homeless. You can't live like that. So the point is you have to get rid of the junk and yet keep the walls. Walls aren't junk. Walls are useful structures. In a similar way, the self can be useful and is necessary, just like a house is useful and necessary for living. It needs to be strong and in some sense fortified and so on, but empty enough that it can be used. So it's kind of like clearing out your house, and then at some point you realize there's an open door and there's an infinite beauty available, and all you have to do is walk out the door. But you didn't know that before because your house was full of boxes and they were blocking the door, many layers thick. And all you could do is read the labels on the boxes and think in those terms. This is really different. So a house is not really a thing in itself. It's something to use as an access point to limitless beauty. So the self could be seen that way, where it's open in a certain way and it is open to the infinite. Now, a teacher, a true teacher, will hold that possibility. It's like saying, I'll hold the door open for you. Just let me know when you're ready. Even in a house that's full of hoarded materials, there is a door. It's just you have to get rid of the junk first. So it helps to start looking at ideas or beliefs you have that are no longer useful. And that can be just about anything. The main ones are the ones that'll upset you when they get triggered. Someone judges you, and the thought is people shouldn't judge. It's a moralistic stance. That's not a useful thought because people judge all the time. So if I attach to the thought that people shouldn't judge, it's just a way for me to strengthen a sense of self that's dysfunctional. I'm caught up. I'm stuck. Simply because I'm opposing reality in that moment. So you start to become honest and real. And the world is full of power games that are full of flattery and insincere praise, lies, all designed to make you feel better about yourself in a similar way that highly processed and low rent cheesecake would be a reward for someone who weighs half a ton. It's designed to keep you where you are and barely functional and really unhappy. And yet if it's the only thing that makes you happy, you're stuck. So the appeals to ego are like cocaine to a drug addict or food to someone who's on the verge of death from being obese. I mean, these are really painful things to contemplate, but they're very real. And to get rid of that is, it's as if to say that you have nothing, you are nothing, you don't matter. Those things are true. That's what Eckhart Tolle saw. I wonder if one of them isn't real. There's no degree of praise for that imaginary self that would have been preferable to waking up. So the question, why would you want to be free, is kind of like, imagine being in prison. Why would you want to be free? I mean, the question kind of answers itself, really, as long as we know what freedom is. And to a prisoner, it's an open door. To someone who's suffering, it's also an open door. It's just usually our houses are too chock full of garbage to notice or to even understand. All we can see are these towers of old newspapers and boxes and junk. It's like our minds are stacked high with bullshit, with lies. There is a sense of, I can no longer live this way. I mean, that's what happened to Eckhart Tolle. It's just unlikely that it's gonna all be gone in a flash like it was with him. It's rare, but it is possible. And it's more typical that we would do it piecemeal. I've talked about this before, but the main thing for me was, especially in my teen years, I could see that I was being prepared to join society. And looking down the line, you know, going to college, getting a job. Of course, that's privilege right there that I was thinking of going to college. But climbing the corporate ladder, earning accolades, raising a family, amassing possessions, whatever, all of that. As a teenager, I started to become aware that it seemed to me like a long cattle chute, like we were being herded down a long chute to a gleaming hall of knives. And that was it. And I wanted no part of it. Now, why did I see it that way? I don't know. I know the story of the Buddha, Gautama. He was a prince and he saw four things: sickness, old age, death, and a wandering ascetic. And it represented basically what suffering is and the way out. And it's an important story. I think for me, it was the death part that was most interesting. It is kind of interesting. It's pretty horrifying if you think about it. And yet I could see the people around me were acting like we're all piling on a lifeboat that had a leak in it. And eventually it was going to go down. And it bothered me. It really bothered me. So I was, in some ways, morbidly fascinated with death as a topic of bad poetry. We could all relate to that probably, and listening to angry rock music and things like that as a way to try to cope, try to rebel. And I did try to rebel. It doesn't work to just drop out of society, and that's a kind of misery, to be homeless and drifting, and I never had to live like that, but I didn't think of that as a way out either. But it felt to me like, through meditation, mainly it was books, I guess. Joel Goldsmith was important, but there were records left by those who had gone before, who had found this freedom, and that struck me. I would say it woke me up a little. It did. It's like a light. Like you're having a bad dream and there's a little bit of a light and it takes you out of the dream a little bit. At some point, that became my focus. I was expected to go to college, get a job, join society, and all of that. I rebelled against it and started to fail pretty badly, and it wasn't going well. So at some point I realized I had to embrace the game, if you will. Go to college, get a job, that kind of thing, but only minimally. Because what I was doing, what I was really interested in, was meditation and studying scriptures and becoming free. So that's what I did. I studied philosophy in college because it was more conducive to these things, but most of what I studied was esoteric literature, Buddhism, and so on. But it started with this sense of being led down this cattle chute. I still don't want any part of that. Who would like that? And that woke me up a little. That's a bracing dose of reality right there. But it was the sacred texts and so on that I delved into and studied assiduously for years. That's what really helped. But it was a driving desire to find this freedom, to be free of all this suffering. I see it where the very best teachers we have are really just beautiful doorways. And what we tend to do is look at the frame. So the personality, the self structure around this access point. Like I said, most people are more like houses that are full of garbage. And so there really isn't an access point there. A true teacher is someone who's free of that. And like I said, is holding the door open and saying, here you go.